When the Beatles touched down in New York on February 7th, 1964, Beatlemania arrived with them.
Oh, yeah, I tell you something. I think you'll understand. When I say that something, I want to hold your hand.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we celebrate 50 years of Beatlemania with some of Iowa's most prominent Beatlemaniacs. Bob Doerr, host of the Beatles Medley on Iowa Public Radio, John Rolfe, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls, and Donna Parsons, who teaches a course on the Beatles at the University of Iowa. I'll also talk with Kathy Mezel, who was one of the screaming girls in the crowd when the Beatles performed live in Chicago in 1964.
And when I touch you, I feel happy inside.
Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When the Beatles touched down at JFK Airport on February 7th, 1964, they were greeted by about 3,000 screaming fans. But Beatlemania didn't really grip the nation until 2 days later when the Fab Four appeared on The Ed Sullivan Show, watched by an audience of 73 million.
And now, here he is, Ed Sullivan.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them, right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you.
This hour, we're celebrating 50 years of Beatlemania with some of Iowa's most prominent Beatlemaniacs. In just a moment, I'll talk with Bob Doerr, host of the Beatles Medley on Iowa Public Radio, John Rolfe, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls, and Donna Parsons, who teaches a course on the Beatles at the University of Iowa. We also want to hear your memories this hour. You can join us on the phone at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can post on our Facebook page. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My first guest today was a teenager in the early 60s when she fell hard for the Beatles. Kathy Mezel lives in East Moline. Hello, Kathy.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure.
And you were into the Beatles before they came to America. Do you remember the first time you heard a Beatles song?
It was on WLS. I listened to the Chicago station all the time. And they hit the Silver Dollar Survey there in March of 63 with Please Please Me. And I liked the song, but it was only on the charts about 2 or 3 weeks, and then it just disappeared. But that was the first time.
And you liked the song.
Yes.
What was the next song you heard?
By the Beatles?
Yeah.
It actually wasn't recorded by the Beatles, but it was... From Me to You by Del Shannon, also on WLS.
So when did you decide that the Beatles were not only a great band, but your band?
When I bought I Want to Hold Your Hand, and I loved I Want to Hold Your Hand, but I flipped over to the B-side and played I Saw Her Standing There, and that was it.
That was
totally.
You were totally gone from that point on. Do you remember watching them on The Ed Sullivan Show?
Oh, yeah. I was just talking to someone about that today, and my whole family was camped out, you know, in the living room, but I was sitting right in front of the TV with my face right in the screen, you know, so they had to see it around me.
And how old were you?
I was 14 at that time.
And you actually got to see them live in Chicago in 1964. Did you have to do a lot of convincing to be able to go to that concert?
Well, actually, I did a lot of attempts to try and get tickets, which didn't work out. But I went to the premiere of A Hard Day's Night, and we were talking with the girls in front of us, and they had an extra ticket to the concert in Chicago. And my friend got it before I could speak up. And I was devastated, but I remember on August 25th, she called me and said her parents weren't going to let her go. And she asked me if I wanted the ticket. So I talked to my parents, and I was totally in tears. And they said, "You really want to go?" And I said, "Yes, yes." So they allowed me to go.
Wow. And what was that like?
It was just pandemonium. Total pandemonium.
Could you even hear the music with all the screaming?
The weird part was I could hear Paul McCartney's bass line. You could tell what they were playing just by following his bass line. And the only time they really, you know, were quiet at all was when he was talking between songs, because they wanted to hear his, you know, accent.
And were you screaming just as much as everybody else during the songs?
No, I screamed at A Hard Day's Night. I was screaming all over the place before that. But at the concert, I was just totally calm. And everyone else around me was just falling apart. until they got to the ending, which was Long Tall Sally. And then I almost fell off my chair when they got into the last part of the song. I remember my hands flew up to my face, and I was like, you know. I had seen all these pictures of girls with their hands on their faces, you know, clawing. And, you know, I was like, I just did that.
So was that the only time you ever got to see them live?
Yes, the Beatles as a group, but I have seen, you know, some of them solo since then.
And I know that you have an extensive Beatles collection. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what you have?
Just about everything I've got. Stuff from the 60s. I started collecting clippings on them in the 60s, and I still do. And records, CDs, tapes, magazines, books, concert programs, autographs, just Beatle dolls, cookie jars, some of the later memorabilia, too. There's still a ton of it being put out.
And you've been going to a Beatles Fest in Chicago for many years as
well?
Oh,
yeah. Yes.
So, you know, a lot of us have teenage obsessions, and those pass with time, and we remember them fondly. But the Beatles have endured for you and for so many others. Kathy, why do you think their music endures?
Well, it's basically what they say. It's kind of a cliche, but it's timeless. And generation upon generation discovers the Beatles. And there's a new generation coming up that are going to be discovering the Beatles. You know, it's just something that's there. You know, it's just part of the air, the environment, I guess.
Well, Kathy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Well, thank you.
Kathy Mazzell is one of the original Beatle maniacs. She was a teenager when the Beatles came to America in 1964. She lives in East Moline. And now some more Beatle maniacs are with me. Bob Doerr is host of the Beatles Medley and also Backtracks on Iowa Public Radio, the leader of the Blue Band. Hello, Bob.
Good morning, Charity.
And thanks again for getting up before 10 o'clock in the morning to
join us.
How
do you do this every day?
Well, practice, practice, practice.
And you have kids.
They help. John Rolfe is also here, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls. Hello, John.
Hi.
And Donna Parsons is here. She's a lecturer at the University of Iowa, and she teaches a course on the Beatles. Hello, Donna.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, welcome back to the show. And Bob, I'll start with you. When was the first time, do you remember the first time you heard the Beatles?
Yes. Actually, I had similar experiences as Kathy. I grew up in suburban Chicago as well, and I'm assuming that she saw them at Comiskey Park on the south side of Chicago. My parents, my mother would not take me. I was 12 years old at that time and could not get a ticket. Even if I got a ticket, Mom was not taking me down to that mecca of mania, I guess that was, in the Chicagoland. But my most vivid, and I had heard their music on WLS as well, but my first most vivid memory was sitting in my Aunt Cora's living room in Itasca, Illinois. That's a far northwestern suburb, and watching that first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. I think we were at Aunt Cora's because she had a 12-inch black and white television set, and we only had a 10.
So you went to watch it on the big screen.
Yeah.
Nice. So, you know, talking to Kathy, there were so many young women who saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show and fell truly, madly, deeply in love with them. Clearly, that's not what happened with you, Bob. But what was it? What was it about them that just captured your imagination?
Well, obviously, they could get girls at that time. And I was just discovering girls at 12 years old. And I don't know. I think the combination of the music, the mayhem, just their posturing, their wit, it just immediately grabbed me. And I immediately went, I want to be John Lennon when I grow up. And it just went from there.
John, where were you when you first heard the Beatles?
We saw them on Ed Sullivan.
So that was your first introduction to them on the Ed Sullivan Show?
Yeah, my sisters and my brother had bought records, 45s already. So I had heard them, but yeah, that was, we had to talk my dad into watching it. He was calling them long-haired kooks.
They were.
And was he convinced by watching them, or did he always hold that opinion?
Pretty much held that, yeah. Yeah, but we were very excited about seeing them.
Well, and Donna, I know that you are not old enough to have watched them on the Ed Sullivan Show. Do you remember when you first started listening to Beatles music when you were growing up?
I remember that they were always there. I had an older brother, so he introduced the music to me. But the first true memory is fourth grade. My general music teacher had created a bulletin board where her students were going to have their favorite songs. And I had been sick, so my contribution came late. She gave me a yellow piece of construction paper, and I wrote Yellow Submarine, right? But it wasn't just Yellow Submarine. I wrote by The Beatles, and I put The Beatles in all caps because I thought everyone needed to know who wrote that masterpiece.
And everyone does. We have this comment from Jane Balvance on Facebook. She says, I saw them on the Ed Sullivan Show for the first time. My dad looked at me and said, she's gone. And I remember feeling miffed about that. How could he know? My face must have betrayed my feelings because I was gone. Gone with my heart, given to the Beatles, my loyalty to them forever. Sheer joy when a Beatles song came on the radio, when their records were played at dances, and when I listened to them on the record player. I traded Beatles cards with my friends and loved Paul the best. I'm grateful to them for filling the empty places of a teenage girl and for giving voice and harmony to teenage angst. And we are going to take a short break here. We'll be back in just a moment, again, with some of Iowa's most prominent Beatle maniacs. We also want to hear your memories this hour. Give us a call at 866-780-9100 as we celebrate 50 years of Beatlemania in the United States. This is Talk of Iowa.
Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please love me do.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour we are celebrating 50 years of Beatlemania in the United States. And with me, Bob Doerr, host of the Beatles Medley on Iowa Public Radio, John Rolfe, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls, and Donna Parsons, who's a lecturer at the University of Iowa and teaches a course on the Beatles. If you go to our Facebook page, you can see a few pictures of Bob Doerr and some of his Beatles memorabilia. And we want to hear your memories this hour as well. Where were you when you first heard or saw the Beatles? What is it about their music that stays with you? 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Donna, put the Beatles in context for us, because the Beatles were just part of the British invasion. They came from a place where there were a lot of young men making music, a lot of bands in Liverpool and in the area. So tell us a little bit about that music scene.
Well, Bill Harry tells us there were probably around 400 bands in Merseyside. And in 1960, Ringo tells us the Beatles were a nothing little band. right? It was Hamburg that really made them. And then when Ringo joins the band in 1962, they leave everyone else in the shadows. And you ask Liverpudlians what set the Beatles apart, and they tell you two things. One is the fact that John and Paul are writing their own songs, and they're being influenced by American rock and roll, right, and by Goffin and King, by Roy Orbison, by Buddy Holly. And they've got that American twist on the music. But the other thing about the Beatles is their charisma. They are so much fun to watch on stage. And unfortunately for us, we never got to see them on Hamburg, on the Hamburg stages where they had to mock show. Because by the time they come back to Liverpool and they're making a big scene in 62, about to hit it in 63 nationally, they've toned it down a bit. Right. So John is just kind of bouncing up and down. But what's really important to remember is the Beatles were the first northern band to make it in London. Right. Because you've got that bit of snobbery looking up at Liverpool. So they have to crack it down in London, and then they're going to take the country by storm.
Well, and Bob and John, let's talk about that early music, because the early Beatles sound that really captured everyone's attention is so different from their sound as they evolve. But what do we hear in those early songs that you think really appeals to people?
Let's see. Melody, harmony, and a beat you could dance to with lyrics that 12 to 18-year-olds could really relate to. What more do you need?
Well, except there was something more, because a lot of bands had that sound. And, you know, they were inspired by other bands that had harmonies, that had these lyrics that, you know, are sort of, they're about love, but they're somewhat shallow. You know, they don't tell you a very deep story about love. Was there something else?
Well, they only got 2 minutes to do it.
It's true. What about you, John? Can you weigh in?
One thing is that they had most of the songs on the album were really good, which wasn't true for a lot of bands around then. They'd have like one or two good songs and then put out an album. The Beatles had pretty strong material throughout the albums.
So there was some depth to what you could find there, as opposed to a one-hit wonder or a one- or two-hit wonder.
Yeah, yeah.
If you looked further, you weren't going to be disappointed. Well,
and it kept on coming. That
yes.
was the thing. You know,
yes.
And sometimes there was three albums out at the same time on a couple of different labels, so you had all this material just flooding the market, and it was, like John said, it was all pretty good.
I'm always struck by the, you mentioned the wit, Donna, of these young men, but they're obviously such smart men. So much intelligence behind this music.
They're very intelligent, and both John and Paul are well-read. The sad thing is that they were not inspired by their teachers. You know, John attends Quarry Bank Grammar School, Paul and George attend Liverpool Institute. They're very prestigious boys' school. In Liverpool, and some of their teachers recognize that talent, but they're not inspiring them. They're not pushing them. And so the Beatles become a little bit more anti-establishment, but they're reading. You know, Paul has read Chaucer. John has read Lewis Carroll.
I want to play just another little piece of tape, and this is a recent piece of tape. This is an interview that Ringo Starr did with Access Hollywood in 2012, talking about that first trip to the United States and really how naive they were about what they were getting into. Here's Ringo Starr.
We flew in from Sweden, he flew in from New York and booked us. Okay, we didn't know. And then it was huge to do Ed Sullivan in those days.
When did you know? When did it hit you?
Well, it hit us actually when we arrived in America, and we had the single was number one, and thanks to Murray the K and Cousin Bruce, and we did a press conference, and they all shouted at us, and we shouted back the New York way, and
right.
We found out later that's why they loved us, because the press actually were coming to bury us, and because we shouted back.
Wow.
But we landed with a number one. It couldn't get any better. You couldn't plan it. 6 months later, you'll have a number one in America. And we had had nothing
at all
till then.
So that was Ringo Starr saying basically they didn't know that the Ed Sullivan Show was a very big deal when they did it. Bob, does that sound sincere to you? Do you think they really didn't know what they were getting into?
Well, you know, the more you get into it, the more you realize that some of it really was orchestrated by Brian Epstein. But for the most part, it did sound, or at least appear, spontaneous. And I would imagine that if you're coming from a small town in England and you're coming to the United States for the first time, you really weren't aware of what was going to go on. And I think all of us now are just realizing the incredible influence, make or break kind of thing that Ed Sullivan had on the music scene. I mean, first, there's only three TV stations available, and he showcased these, you know, he showcased music acts right from the get-go, and apparently was in an airport in England when the Beatles were coming into the airport, and all of a sudden there's this giant turmoil going on there, and Ed, always the consummate talent seeker, just went, what in the world is going on here? And found out that it was the Beatles in England, and that's how he wound up getting them. And it just really sounded like, especially from Ringo's interview, that the synergy all just came together at the right time at the right place.
They had just come back from a tour of Sweden. They landed at Heathrow. The sound of the girls screaming drowns out the jet's engines. And this is what Sullivan sees. And the prime minister is ignored. The newly elected Miss World is ignored. So it's seeing all of that mayhem. And they're when they come into America, they're used to this in England, dealing with the crowds and the screaming. But they're nervous about America because their goal had been to unseat Elvis. And they're unsure how they're going to be received. And when the plane pulls into the airport, they're looking out the windows and they're seeing all these fans and not realizing it's for them.
You know, and also it's right on the tail end of Kennedy's assassination. There was just kind of a void going on in America in the tail end of 1963. And all of a sudden, these very, very happy and very, very cool people show up and filled a cultural void, I think.
We needed to fall in love.
Yes.
John?
Yeah, I agree. I was thinking that, too.
It was really just the right time, the right place. Do you think that England's not a very big country? And I know that the Beatles had been performing in Europe and they had this huge following in England at this time. But do you think that they even grasped the enormity of the United States? I mean, they were on the Ed Sullivan Show and watched by 73 million people, which is an unthinkable audience in England.
Who could grasp that? That'd be tough.
Yeah, absolutely.
George was like 19 or something. I mean, it wasn't even 20 years old. So you got these essentially kind of naive hipsters, and they show up, and holy cow.
Let's go to the phones. A lot of Beatlemaniacs who want to talk to us today, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. We want to hear your memories of when you first heard or saw the Beatles and how they touched your life. Rick is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
This dates before the Ed Sullivan Show. I'm not even sure how young I was, but on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, they always had Raid Record, and he introduced a record by a new group from England called the Silver Beatles, is how he referred to them. And they played the song, and they danced, and then they rated it, and I think it got about a 65. I didn't think they could dance to it. And the reason I remember that is I thought Silver Beatles was a strange name. And it turned out to be the Beatles. And then after that, as they say, the rest is history. But that was the first I remember seeing them or hearing of them.
And they didn't think they could dance to it? Do you remember the song, Rick?
I can't. I know the first one I remember as a kid was I Want to Hold Your Hand. I don't know if that was the one that Dick Clark played or not.
Well, Donna has more information on this. What was it, Donna?
It was She Loves You. It was She Loves You. It's kind of interesting when they
write about the Silver Beatles.
Yeah, they started out as the Quarrymen, And yeah. one point, they call themselves Johnny and the Moondogs. And they're 1960, they're going to audition for Larry Parnes because he needs backing bands for Billy Fury. And they come up with the idea of Beatles. It was Stuart Sutcliffe who came up with that idea in homage of the Crickets, Buddy Holly. And later it'll be John who'll change that second E to an A. But everyone's like, Beatles? What's Beatles? That's a horrible name. What do you mean with that? It should be like Johnny and the Beatles or something. But they actually tried out She Loves You on Paul's dad, Jim. And he didn't like the yeah, yeah, yeahs. He told them, that's enough of those Americanisms. You should say yes, yes, yes. And they're like, Dad, you just don't get it.
Bob, do you have any information on that American bandstand listening to the song?
I do not, but I know that they definitely called themselves the Silver Beatles for a while.
Yeah.
Well, I think they made a good change. Thanks a lot for your call, Rick. Wally's on the line next from Beaverdale. Hi, Wally.
Hi there.
Hi, what's your
Great
memory?
Good morning. Well, my memory is I grew up, spent my junior high years in the little town of New London, Iowa. I've always enjoyed washing the dishes. And right next to that area was a little radio. And, boy, it could pull in a lot of stations. And I can recall WBZ in Boston and KDKA in Pittsburgh playing the Beatles long before WLS or here in Des Moines, KIOA. And I remember hearing Bruce Bradley on BZ saying, here is a great song from England. Perhaps you'll enjoy this. And he was playing it kind of as a novelty. And bingo, every night he played it then. So that was my first response to the Beatles.
And do you remember what made that stand out as opposed to the many other songs coming out of England at that time?
Well, that was the first one out of England for me. Then, of course, you had the British Invasion and all the other bands. But now I just wanted to relate the first time I heard the Beatles, which was a long time before anybody in the Midwest played it. I'm talking a long time. 3 or 4 weeks. it rushed. You know, today it's instant. It's viral, as they say.
Well, Wally, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
All right.
You know, part of that Beatles connection in Chicago between WLS and WCFL, that was the two rival stations in the early 60s, part of that thing was because the Beatles had a couple of songs that were released on VJ Records, which was based in Chicago. And consequently, they got some airplay on both of those stations simply because they were kind of the hometown label at the time.
Capitol passed on putting those out.
They did. And also, I think She Loves You was originally on Swan Records.
Yes, and but, Love Me Do will go to Tolly.
Right.
But it's because Dave Dexter at Capitol would listen to the records, and he thought that he didn't like the harmonica. And he
those
didn't.
Those darn harmonica players.
That's right. And so he passes on Please Please Me, From Me to You, She Loves You. And the problem is Capitol has the right of first refusal. So they get to hear all of the British artists and decide yes or no. And Dave Dexter just doesn't have an ear for rock and roll. It'll take Brian Epstein calling Alan Livingston, the president, saying, listen to this. I want to hold your hand. Do you want it? You got to promote it. You got to plug it.
Dave Dexter might be responsible for the Butcher cover.
That's a joke I don't get. Can you fill those of us who aren't as knowledgeable in on that, John?
That he altered their records when they got the masters from him. Change the order. The American albums are different from the British albums as far as
song selection, how many are on there. Capitol wound up having like two releases out of one that came out of England.
Yes.
But I think, I don't know if you guys, I don't have a Facebook screen in front of me, so I don't know what of the collectibles are posted, but a perfect example of that is what came out originally for Magical Mystery Tour. I think one of the pictures that I sent you was one of the original Magical Mystery Tour releases in England, which came out on 2 7-inch 45 RPM records originally in the very small thing. And then it came to America and they went, oh, no, we can't do that. We're going to put them out on a 12-inch. So you got half of the side was the Magical Mystery Tour songs, and the other was kind of a greatest hits collection in the U.S. So there was a vast difference between what was released in England and the Beatles' original concept and what wound up being issued by Capitol here in the States.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We are celebrating the 50th anniversary of Beatlemania with Bob Doerr, host of the Beatles Medley on Iowa Public Radio, John Rolfe, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls, and Donna Parsons, who's a lecturer at the University of Iowa and teaches a course on the Beatles. We'll be back in just a moment, and we want to hear your memories, too. So give us a call at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa.
Keep all my love forever.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Beatlemania, when the Beatles first arrived in the United States on February 7th. Of course, they performed on the Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964. With me today, Bob Doerr, host of the Beatles Medley and Backtracks on Iowa Public Radio. He's also the leader of the Blue Band. Also, John Rolfe is here, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls, and Donna Parsons, who teaches a course on the Beatles at the University of Iowa. And Donna, I know you've been spending your summers in England researching the Beatles. What are you looking for?
When I go to Liverpool, the past couple summers, I've been tracking down the venues where they played. And it may be what's now called the Dovey, which had been Dovedale Towers, which had been St. Barnabas, the church hall. And you walk in, and it's been renovated beyond recognition, but they're like, okay, the Beatles played over in that corner. Or, for instance, last summer I went to Ellesmere Port, and found Civic Hall, where the Beatles performed in 1963. And, of course, all the doors are locked, but I found a little bell that said ring for service. And the manager came, told him, I teach a course on the Beatles, and he offered to show me around. So I went into this auditorium on ground floor, balcony. There had been two dressing rooms that I'd not sure which one the Beatles used, so let's go look at them both. Let's figure out backstage where they could have exited to get away from the fans, and let's walk on stage. So I literally got to stand where Paul stood, and you look out and think, what would he have seen? You know, where would the line of vision have been? And dodging, right, those jelly beans. Because George Harrison had told a journalist that jelly beans were his favorite candy. And so if I'm 12, 13 years old and I've got a crush on George, I'm going to the concerts and taking these jelly beans to give to him, except I'm hurling them on the stage. And sometimes I get so excited I forget to take them out of the packet, and I hurl the entire packet. I've been tracing where people are buried. So, for instance, this summer I found Agnes Henderson. She was the wife of John Henderson. Remember, being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, the Hendersons will all be there. Right, later Pablo Fanqua's fair. And Pablo Fanqua was based in Lancashire. And, you know, the Beatles know, they're aware of this. So finding that grave, or just going to Yew Tree Cemetery and finding where Mary McCartney was buried. There's no gravestone, but we know the site. And just walking around the Penny Lane district and really figuring out, okay, here's the shelter in the roundabout. Walk down the street, here's the fire station. Walk around the roundabout, and here's the barbershop. and really things that you can reach out and touch. They're still there.
You also talk to a lot of people, of course, who were Beatles fans back in the day. What do the women of Liverpool tell you about the Beatles?
It's really fun talking with people. There's a new Museum of Liverpool, which opened in the last couple of years, and there's a pretty big Beatles exhibition. And I met two couples one time, and they told me how they went to see the Beatles in 1963, and they couldn't hear because the girls were screaming. And one of them had wanted to hear Mary Wells, and the girls were actually screaming at her to get off the stage because they only wanted to hear the Beatles. And what's a bit scary is that the girls were actually standing on the seats screaming and flailing. And you could hear the first couple seconds of a song because they'd want to know what it was. And then they'd scream, and they'd scream with the full power and force of their body, and they'd lose consciousness, and they would faint. And we also have tales where the girls lost control of their bladders. None of these women admit that, and I don't ask them. I just ask them what they remember. And if you go to the British Library in London, into the Ripatt Gallery, there is a display of Beatles memorabilia, right, that's been collected by Hunter Davies. So you've got the lyrics, and you can push a button and listen to various songs. And I met another couple. They were going to go to the British Museum to see an exhibition. And one told me how she had all the Beatles fan club magazines, and she regretted not having them now. She sold them because she needed the money when she got married. And another one told me that her bedroom was decorated in Beatles wallpaper, and that they actually had another roll of the wallpaper, and she's wondering where it went. So they talk about, you know, they know all the songs. They yeah. may not be listening to them quite now, but they remember all the lyrics, and they will tell me about, oh, yeah, that long hair, that was wild for us too. Right. But it's very much a part of their lives and their growing up.
Bob, did you grow your hair out to look like the Beatles?
I tried to.
How about you, John?
I've got a Beatle cut now, actually.
Wonderful. Let's get back to the phone. So many people want to share their memories. Carol's on the line from Waterloo. Hi, Carol.
Hi.
Hi. What's your memory?
Oh, I remember back in 64. I had a sister that was 8 years older than I was, and she was a huge, you know, 50s audiophile, and she loved the Beatles. I mean, she loved Elvis, and she loved Everly Brothers and Chubby Checker and all those. And the first day I heard "I Want to Hold Your Hand," I thought, all right, finally, music for my generation. Music, I had to run out and get my 45s to each one of them.
So that was the first music that really moved you, that made you need to own a record.
Exactly. That was, yeah, I mean, I liked her music and I liked to dance to it and everything, but no, she's an Elvis freak, and I guess I was a Beatles freak.
Carol, thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
And we have John on the line in Fairfield with a different kind of story. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi. What's your story?
Well, I didn't really develop an interest in the Beatles music until years later. My older brother was an Elvis Presley fan, so I was heavily under his influence and enjoyed Elvis Presley. The Beatles came along in 64, and I just noticed all the younger teenage girls screaming about him, and I thought, that's kind of immature, and I never got interested in their music until years later when I started noticing some of the lyrics and really then appreciated songs like In My Life, for example. I think I read a story about that being related actually to appreciation that he learned from his mother. I'm not certain of that, but anyway, the lyrics just really spoke to me. And then they, in the late 60s, learned, of course, Transcendental Meditation in India with the Maharishi. And lo and behold, 4 years ago, I learned Transcendental Meditation finally at the young age of 62.
So you've been on a similar journey to the Beatles, only much, much later.
Right, yeah, I could really appreciate and can appreciate their music a lot more now than I could 30, 40 years ago.
Well, John, thank you so much for your call. And Bob, was there some conflict between Elvis fans and Beatles fans?
I think there was. Obviously, the Beatles had great reverence for Elvis until Elvis started doing the Las Vegas trip, and then John Lennon kind of went out of his way to say, what's up with that? But I think there was a crossover. I mean, certainly the Beatles initially were an American rock and roll cover band until they started to write their own material. So I think there was a crossover there.
Right, and certainly an influence there as well. When do you feel, Bob and John, you can both weigh in on this, when do you feel that the Beatles were really at the height of their power? I mean, they took America by storm, but as I mentioned, their music really evolved and their lyrics really evolved and got more complex and deeper as time went on. When do you feel they were at their peak?
What do you think, John?
Summer of Love, 67.
Why?
Sergeant Pepper. I think that might have been the peak, maybe.
What do you think, Bob?
You know, I was a big fan and still am of the very, very early stuff because it was simple, it was easy to relate to, it was fun, and all of that. As far as their evolution of being great music masters, certainly Sergeant Pepper's, I think, defines them, or maybe the one before that, Rubber Soul.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was, I think Rubber Soul was, or is now generally accepted as the first album concept kind of thing where every song kind of fit together and it wasn't a single song kind of thing where up until or in the early 60s when the music business was definitely just controlled by the publishers, it was a song kind of oriented thing. And then by the time they came up with Rubber Soul, it became an album concept kind of deal. So it was not only a Beatle evolution, but an evolution of the people who followed them. They grew up, they were looking for something more, and the Beatles delivered every single time.
I think when you say that kind of puts in a nutshell part of how or why people who were Beatles fans are still Beatles fans. Because a lot of us do outgrow our teen obsessions. But since the Beatles had such a long career together and wrote such interesting music as they evolved throughout that career, I think that may explain some of that connection that people continue to have with them. What do you think about that, Bob?
I think you're right.
Let's get back to the phones. There are a lot of people who want to share their memories. Mary's on the line next in Cedar Falls. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to share, I was only about 8 years old when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I had never heard anything like this before. And their music, I listened to that music so much that their music is like a part of my fiber. It's a part of my being. Every note of every song I memorized and could sing along with, and just the feeling that I got listening to their music was just really something. I think it had more influence on me than probably any other music I've ever heard. I also remember where I was when the Hard Day's Night movie came out. I remember going to that movie at the Regent Theater in Cedar Falls. I remember where I was sitting even. I just have a vivid picture in my mind of being at that movie, and I remember that we were all trying to scream and be like the teenage girls that we saw at the concert.
Mary, thank you so much. And Donna, the movie, The Hard Day's Night, and other appearances that the Beatles did, did that serve to make them even more accessible to these young people who were fans? I mean, that's such a charming film.
For Hard Day's Night, it gave them more exposure in America. And then you have people like David Crosby who go and see the film and walk out and say, I know what I want to do for the rest of my life. And you have John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas saying, I want to write like this. So it's very much, and you were talking about their peak, and part of that depends on how we define their peak. Are we looking at how they're playing as a band? Because you've got Rubber Soul, and everyone is so invested in how well they're playing and the solos, and they're really working together. If we're talking about musical experimentation, we go to Revolver. We go to a track, Tomorrow Never Knows, where we've got tape loops and we've got a monotonic song, and what the heck is this? And then we go to Sgt. Pepper, where it really is a live performance. The Beatles are sending the album out to tour, and for the first time, we've got lyrics printed on the back of the cover. So you can sit and contemplate and think about those lyrics. Liverpudlians will tell you Sgt. Pepper is about our life, right? It's speaking to a world that's disappearing.
Let's go back to the phones. Rudy is on the line in Fairfield. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to share?
Well, I just wanted to remark over again, other people, the enthusiasm I want to hear more of. We, after Hard Day's Night, like this woman was just saying, we just went completely insane. There would be guys and girls, maybe 20, 30 of us, and we stayed out all night long just running and laughing, screaming, and it affected everybody. It wasn't. I saw the Beatles, too, and I did hear all the screaming. And one quick thing I read somewhere where someone said the Beatles had, as if had created a new color. It was sort of like that. It changed the world that much that it was never to be the same again. And the social impact of the Beatles is what I'm now interested in, at the start of the youth revolution of the 60s. And they just rode the wave, and it changed the world completely. I mean, I'm still a total Beatle maniac. I don't listen to I Want to Hold Your Hand all the time, but I'm so into what they did to the world, you know.
Well, Rudy, thanks a lot for calling. Like, they created a new color. That's such a wonderful way to explain it. And we're nearly out of time, but Bob, let's talk about, as we close out, that question, why the Beatles endure, why there are still Beatlemaniacs 50 years later. What do you think?
Well, they started out with millions right there on the Ed Sullivan Show. And maybe John can speak in a couple of seconds as to the collectability and if people are still buying records and things. I mean, he owns a record store.
John?
I find that I think the vast majority of sales are from like Rubber Soul, Revolver, Sgt. Pepper. There's still interest in some of the earlier stuff, but it seems like that mid to later period still is affecting people.
Still really resonates with people. And Donna, of course, you have classrooms of students who are going to spend a semester with you learning about the Beatles, who may have listened a lot in the past, or maybe they haven't listened a lot in the past. But why do you think the Beatles keep drawing in new generations?
It really is the quality of the music. And it's also, look at what the Beatles did in 8 years. And they've raised the bar that no one has yet met. They've set a standard. And I think my students, they'll come in, and some of them will have a lot of knowledge about the songs. They'll know the songs, but they won't know the story. And so they want to know. I have some who may be Rolling Stones fans, and they want to know, what is all the fuss about? But usually by the time we get to Rubber Soul, they've been hooked. And by the end of the semester, all they're listening to is Beatles, right? And what I'm also finding with my students is that they're now collecting vinyl, that they're going to the stores and they're buying the singles and the albums, and they want to hear the vinyl.
Why do they say that? Why do they say this has grabbed them like that?
Because no one of their generation has. No one of their generation has. So why do the Beatles have such a hold on their generation? And that music is still speaking to us. Those hopes, those concerns, those worries, those fears, those dreams would be timeless.
Thank you all so much for being here today. Donna Parsons is a lecturer at the University of Iowa. She teaches a course on the Beatles. Bob Doerr, thank you.
Thank you, Charity.
Bob Doerr, host of the Beatles Medley on Iowa Public Radio. And John Rolfe, thank you.
My pleasure.
John Rolfe, owner of Metro Records in Cedar Falls. This is Talk of Iowa.